You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated...
It is Wednesday, March 16th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we'll be welcoming Greg Mitchell, author of The Age of WikiLeaks, also a writer with The Nation magazine. More updates on Japan. I don't even know what to say about this. It's such a horrible, horrible disaster there. I guess for the first time since an earthquake killed 6,000 people in Japan, the emperor has addressed the people. Last night at one point it looked like, and of course all the attention... At this point, I mean, aside from the fact that the country has been devastated by this earthquake, there are 3,000 or 4,000 confirmed dead with another 6,000 or 7,000 unaccounted for. I have a feeling both those numbers are going to rise dramatically from the earthquake. And in particular, the tsunami seems to have really been just devastating. The tsunami... many images last night and reports of, I was watching CNN and they have signs, tsunami warning areas. And apparently the tsunami went inland just miles beyond where they had ever anticipated a tsunami could go. So you've got just thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands displaced. In the freezing cold, electricity is spotty throughout much of the country, and people are keeping an eye on this Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. There are six or seven reactors there.
Six reactors,
and it seems like at any given hour there's a different reactor that's having a different problem. And last night, at one point, it looked like they had only left about 50 workers there at the plant. I guess a skeletal crew to attempt to continue to get water, essentially, on these fuel rods. There are problems with some of the spent fuel rods, and they have been using seawater to cover these rods, essentially, as a cooling mechanism. You know, once you put the seawater in there, you've given up the ghost on saving these plants, of course. At this point, it's not even a consideration. The issue is whether or not half that country will be poisoned with radiation. And it's almost incomprehensible to imagine what the Japanese people must be going through, without really any ability at this point to recover from the tsunami and the earthquake, because there's this massive fear that that they will not be able to control meltdowns at these, in particular, these six reactors. There was an attempt by military helicopters to drop water on the number three reactor. It failed because essentially I think the radiation levels are too hot and they couldn't fly close enough. Is that right? I mean, is that...
No, my understanding is that they were trying to dump it on the pools that hold the spent fuel to cool that down, but that, yeah, whatever's going on with the containment in number three, there was too much radioactive steam for the helicopters to get close.
And there are multiple sort of containment chambers. There's the primary one, I guess the secondary one, and the third one is the actual sort of building itself.
No. The building would be a fourth one. There are three actual. That's what made this initially seem like it might be a safer situation than Chernobyl, because there's the whole another level of containment, but it seems like they might all be failing in reactor three.
So there's a great breakdown. I'm not going to read the whole thing for you because it's just simply too long. But listener Eric sent me a from... Zero Hedge, a great breakdown that I guess much of the information came from Reuters. Just a horrible situation. There's not, you know, there are better sources than I to get this information from. Rachel's been doing great work on MSNBC and sort of just outlining these issues. What's clear, though, no matter what coverage you're getting, is that TEPCO, the firm that runs these reactors, that built these reactors, has been less than forthcoming with what's going on there. Now, you know, one can only imagine how difficult it is to get real communications out of this situation and what the Japanese government is willing to tell its own people. But, you know, and at this point, I think China has now put a moratorium on their building of nuclear reactors. And it's not like, you know, they don't operate under the standard, the same sort of domestic pressures that we see in a place like Germany or Switzerland that has also frozen the building of their nuclear power plants. But, you know, it's almost impossible to imagine. I said this yesterday. I'll reiterate it. Regardless of whether you believe in a technical sense, and from a technological sense, nuclear power can be made absolutely safe, it's almost impossible to imagine that you could trust our regulatory structure and industry in this country to do so. It's just, I mean, it just bends the imagination at that point. And I noticed that Digby over at Hullabaloo had a link to a report that was presented, I guess, a month ago, outlining how it would be possible to, by 2050, to move to completely renewable sources of energy, safer. And, you know, I will leave others to determine whether or not that's actually feasible. But it's very, you know, to build these nuclear power plants with billions upon billions of dollars of our money subsidized by the government with the limited liability that they have for some reason, you know, up to like $600 million. I mean, $600 million right now, it seems like a joke. And one has to wonder if they're that convinced of their safety, why would they need such limited liability? So, you know, that's that. The limitations of this show are such that it doesn't behoove any of us for me to sit here and pontificate about this stuff. It's such a tragedy, and you can get better information at other sources. Then that's that. I mean, I feel at a loss. It's just unimaginable. It's just unimaginable tragedy, and hopefully. It won't get worse. Hopefully it won't get worse. So let's look domestically. I mean, this is not to mention also, as we look internationally, we have a situation where the Saudis, I think, are about to send troops to Bahrain. And we're starting to see the simmering tension between Shiites and Sunnis in that region grow. We have this the obviously the Shia Sunni tensions in Iraq, and you've got a Sunni regime in the Saudis sending troops to put down what appears in many respects to be a Shiite rebellion in Bahrain, and this could just get worse. And you have to imagine now, you have like two American allies using American military hardware to repress a Shiite uprising in Bahrain. Friance and Piance, as our last president would say. And in this own, in our own country, we have a an equally building environmental problem. Just in the sensibility of our government, we're living at a time where of the 10 hottest years on record, 9 of them have happened this century, in the past, I guess, 11 years, 10 years. And the other one was in 1998. There is irrefutable evidence that the planet is warming. And we have more and more examples of how this is affecting our climate. Severe weather, whether it was the fires in Russia last year, the increases in droughts, the intensities of storms, how it's affecting our food supply. So the Republicans are working overtime now to strip the EPA from its regulatory authority to regulate greenhouse gases. It is a statutory authority. It can only be removed by statute. And Republicans are busy at work trying to strip the EPA of that authority. The House Energy and Commerce Committee on Monday marked up this legislation, which would bar the EPA from regulating these greenhouse gases. Democrats proposed a series of amendments just to attach to these bills a statement with really no other implications other than just being a resolution that would concede, admit, point out, state the obvious, however you want to phrase this, the reality of global warming. One of the language was, the scientific evidence is compelling that elevated concentrations of greenhouse gases resulting from anthropogenic, I believe that's human, or human-made emissions, are the root cause of the recently observed climate change. Not one of the 31 House Republicans who sits on these committees would vote for it. They will not admit the existence of climate change. And that comes on the heels of a poll that shows that the number of Americans who are worried about global warming has fallen to the nearly historic low reached in 1998. Just 51% of Americans, or one percentage point more than 1998, said they worry a great deal or a fair amount about climate change. The high was in 2008 after Al Gore won his UN, excuse me, when Al Gore put out his movie and won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I guess along with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, two-thirds of Americans at that point. So it's dropped about 15 percentage points. And meanwhile, in the Senate, in an attempt, I don't know if this is an attempt or what, but there is going to be a vote on this bill in the Senate. I don't know why. Perhaps it's because Obama wants to be able to veto this. Maybe he won't. Who knows what he'll do at this point. But there will be a vote in the Senate. There's going to be an attempt to defeat it. And there is going to be a an amendment by Jay Rockefeller to just have a two-year moratorium on the EPA doing this. Because, you know, well, what are you going to do? The planet's warming. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? I just, it's just stunning. We're living in a completely effed up age. And it is also the age of WikiLeaks. So we will take a break, and when we return, we will be talking to Greg Mitchell about that very age. At a time now where Bradley Manning, they're still stripping him at night. They're taking away his boxer short, but they're putting him in some type of burlap sack to sleep in, literally. A burlap sack. More to humiliate this guy, perhaps in response to the fact that the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian newspaper have all come out with op-eds saying the treatment of Manning is reprehensible. It harkens back to the worst of the Bush administration. It is a complete reversal from Obama's position on the campaign trail, and it's a national embarrassment. And so the DOD has responded by putting him in a burlap sack. For what reason? Nobody's quite sure. The psychiatrist in Quantico refused to say that this guy is a suicide risk. So there you have it. When we come back, Greg Mitchell on WikiLeaks. We'll be right back after this. Hi, folks. You can always support the show and get great coffee, tea, or chocolate by going to justcoffee.coop. Putting the coupon code MAJORITY in the coupon box, get a 10% discount, get some great fair trade coffee. And, of course, the real way that this show is going to be able to continue is if you become a member now. You can do so at majority.fm. You get almost an hour of extra daily show, plus some swag, plus knowing that you're supporting independent media. Thanks. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Apparently, we're having some trouble getting in touch with Greg Mitchell. We will plow forward. Plenty in the news. As I mentioned, Bradley Manning, again, apparently the pushback from these different op-eds, and in the wake of P.J. Crowley, the State Department spokesperson, being fired for stating the obvious that the treatment of Bradley Manning has been stupid and counterproductive and unnecessary. The DOD, they still take his underwear away, but they put him in like a large burlap sack, an engineered burlap sack that is consistent with the humiliation and the attempts to break someone down in prison. I think there's actually a quote from Manning. This comes from a report from him. Though I am still required to strip naked in my cell at night, I am now given the smock to wear. First, I did not want to wear this item of clothing due to how coarse it was and how uncomfortable it felt. However, the brig now orders me to wear the smock at night. So there you have it. It really is stunning. It really is stunning. And this, there was a report somewhere that Obama was looking for ways to reach out to his base. How about just reaching out to some form of responsibility. I mean, this is it's just stunning. And this story, which really set alarm bells off for me, there, it came via the Jonathan Shiat at the New Republic, who is the New Republic, of course, their job is to be the responsible element of the Democratic Party. In other words, basically just the establishment and administration ass kissers, more often than not. And he quotes this piece from Alexander Bolton in The Hill, which is a sort of like a, you know, it's a small paper that goes to staffers and whatnot. And, you know, again, when you see stuff like this, it just sets off alarm bells with me because it is clearly somebody's trying to frame the context of the debate. And the title of this piece, Social Security Reform Splits White House Political and Economic Teams. Now, we have heard for months that there was rumor that Obama may bring up Social Security, quote-unquote, reform, which means cuts to Social Security. Completely irrelevant in terms of the deficit Social Security is. I mean, I guess to the extent that, you know, it's relevant in the same way that if we said we're going to default on all our bonds and all our loans, that would be relevant to the deficit too. If we didn't have to pay anybody back for anything, then yes, we would cut our deficit. But then if we weren't going to pay anybody back for anything, we wouldn't have to worry about the deficit because there wouldn't be one. If we defaulted on all of our loans and our bonds, then of course, yes, there would be no deficit. So that's what you would have to say is the only connection between the deficit and Social Security. That's just the reality of it. So we have this story with a Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, National Economic Council Director Gene Sperling, and Sperling's deputy Jason Furman, leading figures in the president's economic team, are pressing Obama to cut Social Security benefits if necessary, say sources familiar with their positions. But Obama's political team, led by David Axelrod, David Plouffe, and Jim Messina, are urging the president to understand that backing benefit cuts could prove disastrous to his 2012 election hopes, sources say. The political team is winning the argument so far, but internal debate rages at the White House as Republicans in Congress insist sweeping efforts to restore government finances must include Social Security reform. There are two camps, the source added. One camp wants to be able to throw a bone to the Republicans and some centrist Democrats. The political people prefer not to be accused of being the party that cuts Social Security in those ways. Some political people would like to see the president out there defending the program and making the case that it has nothing to do with the deficit. When I read something like this, that there is a leak from the White House, obviously, I mean, this is obviously coming from the White House, that the responsible economic people, the economic advisors say we must cut Social Security, and the political people are saying don't cut it because it's bad for electoral politics, I get very, very worried. In addition, obviously, to these economic advisors who are basically saying to the president, look, you can default on the loans that have been offered to us by the Social Security Trust Fund. You can default on those bonds, and these are interest-bearing bonds. Remember that. The loans that the Social Security Trust Fund has made to the general fund is actually bearing interest. Hundreds of billions of dollars of interest a year. You can default on those promises because that was just money lent to us by workers, by the middle class. We would never, ever think to suggest that you default on the loans that were paid to us by foreign countries, by large institutional players, by millionaires and billionaires who have bought treasury bonds, or investment bankers for that matter, who have bought treasury bonds because they were a solid investment, a solid, safe, and secure investment. Those we would never suggest that you default on. The ones coming from Social Security, yes, we would suggest that you do. This piece also says the trust fund has a theoretical 2.6 trillion surplus, but that money has been spent by the federal government, like general revenues. See, this is fascinating phrasing of this, because we would never say, well, yes, you have a bond, but it's theoretical. Yes, it's on paper, but it's theoretical. It's a theoretically, the U.S. government will pay you back. No, what we say in those instances is that this is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, which makes it the safest investment probably in the world at this point, which is why interest rates are so low, which is why when you loan us money, we give you such a small return because it's so safe and secure. But the use of theoretical in this context is a clear indication of where the writer is coming from. And then we have Jonathan Chiat responding that, oh, this would be a great move by the president. I'd argue that politically speaking, I mean, can you imagine now? We know all the numbers on Social Security, right? We know that, and in fact, I would argue that it was the polls that came out at the end of last year that showed that Republicans are more trusted on Social Security than Democrats are now. The Republican Party, who has been trying to dismantle Social Security for 70 years, is more trusted than Democrats. We know that poll after poll after poll after poll show that 80% of the American people say, do not touch Social Security. That would include some Tea Partiers. That would include many Republicans. So we know this. But Chiat argues, politically speaking, obtaining a bipartisan deal on the deficit is likely to be popular. While the specifics of cutting entitlements are extremely unpopular, the general meta message of bipartisan cooperation is highly popular. People tend to follow the broad heuristics of whether the parties are getting along rather than the specifics. I got news for you. You cut people's pension that they and their ancestors have paid into, their parents have paid into, just in the same way that your parents benefited from their parents paying into the system. That's not likely to be defeated by the broad heuristics of bipartisan support. But this, of course, is part of the agenda. This is the sales job of the moneyed elite and their water carriers in the establishment media to the American public. That look, yes, the 60% of you who rely on Social Security for over 50% of your retirement income, the next quintile, which is surely about to edge into that same category of relying on Social Security for more than 50% of your retirement income because your 401ks were devastated, you will bask in the heuristics of bipartisan support as you enjoy a wonderful cat food dinner tonight. Would you care for some bipartisan Chablis with that Friskies buffet you're eating? Meanwhile, speaking of establishment hypocrites and everything that is wrong with our elite in this country, Ezra Klein has a great piece on the sad, hypocritical retirement of Evan Bayh. This is a twofer for me, because one, I love to see Evan Bayh shat upon. He deserves it. And two, I love to see him shat upon by someone who frankly paid Evan Bayh far more respect than he deserved as a senator. He writes, Evan Bayh wasn't a particularly distinguished senator. He was a popular Democrat in a red state. Very much one of these so-called centrist Democrats who were, in fact, conservative. They're conservatives. And particularly a guy like Bayh is a financial conservative. And by financial conservative, I think we all know what that means. Steal from the working class, steal from the middle class, redistribute wealth upwards on the income spectrum. He writes, when he decided not to seek re-election in 2010, he published a precise and devastating broadside against the institution which he and his father had served. Oh, I should remind you, Evan Bayh, a real bootstraps guy, served in the Senate. I don't even think they had to, did they have to change the placard for him? Served in the Senate after his father, a real self-made man in the sense that he had the good sense not to change his last name. He condemned the bitter partisan place. He went on to talk that filibuster should require 35 senators to make a commitment to continually debate. The number of votes needed to overcome a filibuster should be reduced from 55 to 60. He went after money in politics, calling for, quote, legislation to enhance disclosure requirements, require corporate donors to appear in the political ads they finance, and prohibit government contractors or bailout beneficiaries from spending money on political campaigns, not to mention public matching funds for smaller contributions. A real reformer. And he called for this bold reform as he was leaving the Senate. And Ezra wrote at the time he should stay in the Senate where he could do some good. But he didn't want to stay in the Senate, he told me in subsequent interviews. He waxed rhapsodic over his time teaching at Indiana University's Graduate School of Business. Quote, it was real, it was tangible, and it was making a difference every day. He wanted that feeling again. He wanted to come home at night, he told me, and say, dear, do you know what we got done today? I got this really bright kid in my class, and you know what he asked me? Here's what I told him, and I think he saw a little epiphany. I saw a little epiphany moment go off in his mind. I want to be engaged in an honorable line of work, is what he told Ezra Klein. But it turns out Ezra did not return to Indiana to teach. He did not, as he said he was thinking of doing, joining a foundation. No, rather, he went to work for the massive law firm, McGuire Woods. And who does McGuire Woods work for? Principal clients served from our Washington offices include national energy companies, foreign countries, international manufacturing companies, trade associations, and local and national businesses. He followed up by signing on as a senior advisor to Apollo Management Group, a giant public equity firm. And finally this week, he joined Fox News as a contributor. That leads me to believe that we may be hearing from Greg Mitchell. Let me take a break. We'll be right back after this. Hello, Greg. I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised.
About to lose. You fascist about to lose. You
All right, folks, we are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar here on the phone. We are fortunate enough to have Greg Mitchell. He is the author of The Age of WikiLeaks. He, of course, is also a writer at The Nation magazine. And you can check out his blog at The Nation on a daily basis. He has been updating WikiLeaks for how many days have you been doing that now?
109 today, and it's been kind of hourly. You know, it's I think it's the only live blog that that didn't end after 4 days, and so for better or worse, it's still going on 109 days, which gives you a way to judge how many days it's been since the Cablegate releases began.
Now, releases are coming out every day. Is that right?
Right, they're still coming out. Yeah.
So,
and you know, the latest today is just they announced that the one of the big news outlets in Turkey is going to start releasing the cables related to Turkey, and as we all know, it's a very important ally and one of the biggest troves of cables actually relate to Turkey. So it shows how this is almost a never-ending process.
So let's talk about let's start with this. What are some of the WikiLeaks information? This is all the, and when we talk about the cables, when we talk about information that came from Iraq, we're talking about information that was allegedly uploaded to WikiLeaks servers by Bradley Manning. Is that correct?
Right. Right. Well, this goes back, my book really covers the whole past year. It's been almost exactly a year now since WikiLeaks really became a household name, started to become a household name in the U.S. The first thing, of course, was the collateral murder video from Iraq showing the killing of civilians on the ground. And then we went into the Afghanistan war logs, and then the Iraq war logs, and then finally at the end of November, the Cablegate. So the book really traces the whole past year, and what some would say ties it all together, besides Julian Assange becoming kind of a superstar, is Bradley Manning is accused of leaking all of that. Now, there are some people who say, you know, maybe he's totally innocent. There are others who say maybe he's totally guilty of all that, and then there are others who say that he couldn't have possibly leaked all of that. So, but those are the four major releases from the past year. Bradley Manning, allegedly at the center of all of it.
And so what would you say are the most important, I mean, are there any most important leaks, or is it sort of the totality? I mean, the interesting thing to me, I noted at one point, is, occasionally, you do these pundit hits on television, and it got beyond sort of the meta story of these being leaks from WikiLeaks. And
right.
the information that we have gleaned from these leaks just became information that was out there. I mean, just off the top of my head, the U.S. government relationship with Suleiman was revealed through the WikiLeaks cables, and or at least a lot more sort of expansive information about the U.S. relationship with Suleiman, who was the vice president
briefly
appointed by Mubarak. That just started getting quoted as sort of a fact, as opposed to, like, this is a story that WikiLeaks has presented.
Right. Well, that's been the amazing thing in this whole process. If you go back, even if you just ignore the rest of the year and all the revelations about Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth, just looking at the cables is, there's a tremendous amount of publicity the first few days. And then I think people expected again that it would fade as it had done earlier. But because cables kept coming out pertaining to different parts of the world, I think that's it's some way what you're referring to, in the sense that things have become so scattered and for all different countries of the world. And WikiLeaks has been savvy in releasing cables sometimes when different parts of the world became hotspots. So they became very much part of the discussion. And you know, it was actually sort of amusing, as I point out in the book, that so many times the same newspapers, the New York Times and the Guardian and the Washington Post and so forth, would be ripping Assange or WikiLeaks. And then they would be very happily quoting from the new cables on their front pages. But in terms of what's the most important, of course, it depends what part of the world. There are a lot of cables that didn't cause much of a ripple in the U.S., but were gigantic in scattered parts of the world. For example, who in the U.S. knows that there's a real government crisis in Indonesia over WikiLeaks cables published in Australia going right now?
Interesting.
But I think most people would agree that in terms of full impact, and you really can't, you don't know the full impact, but it's so mammoth, it's potentially so mammoth, it's staggering, is the cables on Tunisia, which certainly at the minimum helped fuel the rebellion there. I think everyone agrees to that extent. That rebellion, of course, then spread to Egypt and throughout the Middle East and North Africa. And in Egypt, again, we can't say the cables that were released there fueled or, you know, sparked the revolt, but they certainly, again, helped frame it for the media, helped inform, helped kind of blow Suleiman out of the water. All the cables about Mubarak corruption, police torture, other abuses. Then we moved on to, you know, Bahrain and Yemen and Libya. So each of those cables all had an impact of some extent and possibly great extent in, you know, the last couple months of rebellion there.
And I think it's important, too, to point out that there were something like over 200,000 cables. And at this point, we've only seen a fraction of these. Is that right?
Yeah, it might be up to 10,000. I mean, it was 5,000 out of a quarter million as of a week or so ago. There's been a lot that's come out this week. I think the India, you know, again, who in the U.S. knows about the cables in India? Well, about 2 days ago, they released 5,100 cables in India, which, again, mammoth coverage there, mammoth impact in India and its relations with others, relations with the U.S. and so forth. That was 5,000 cables there. So I imagine they're over 10,000 by now.
And so we're talking about less than 5%.
Yeah, well, I'm not that great at math, but 10,000, maybe 12,000 by now out of 250,000. But you know, look, I said early on, I was interviewed, I mean, this has been going on 3 months now, I was interviewed early on when it seemed like the, you know, cables were starting to fall back, and you know, people were saying, well, do we think the other 248,000 are meaningless? And I said, we really don't know. We don't know whether they haven't been published by the major news outlets because they're trivial, or they just haven't gotten to them. Well, it turned out that largely they hadn't gotten to them. And, you know, the New York Times had to admit that it totally blew the Egypt cables because they had them, and they didn't even bother to search them. And then when Egypt blew up, suddenely there's all these damning cables. So that was an example of
that's pretty stunning. That's pretty stunning that nobody, you know, nobody. I mean, I would imagine
didn't bother to search.
Yeah, I would imagine the first thing you do is you put these into a searchable database, and then you just start putting in terms as the news comes up.
Well, they did that, but they had to rant. They felt, you know, mainstream media. And remember, we talked early on; it was just the New York Times, the Guardian, and, you know, three other places. And, you know, they are strapped for staff and so forth. And I think they sat down and said, what are the eight most important areas, you know, and they have Iraq and Afghanistan and so on and so forth, and whatever else they saw as hot, and left out, you know, Egypt and some other places, Libya. And so they didn't bother to search them. So, I mean, I can believe that the vast majority of the cables that haven't come out are, you know, are trivial. But given the track record, I could also believe that there's, you know, tremendous amount of stuff still in there. You know, that is, you know, we've seen things on Mexico that have come out recently that are incredible. Has had incredible impact there. So all you can say is, who knows?
Well, let me ask you this: are the Would you say, give me a sense of the breakdown of how many, I mean, because, you know, one of the things that when, and it seems to have completely, this push to sort of prosecute Assange and WikiLeaks as some type of, it seems to have basically completely fallen by the wayside. I think that probably happened a couple of weeks ago when the Defense Department basically admitted we have no way of doing this, and there may be still some senators out there who think they can get some mileage out of pretending that Assange is public enemy number one. But to what extent? But my argument at the time was I hadn't read a single cable on WikiLeaks website. Every single cable I ever read was via a newspaper.
Right, right. Well, that was true the first month. No doubt. The Guardian, the New York Times, Der Spiegel, two other outlets. That was completely true. I mean, WikiLeaks sort of gave over the vetting and the publishing to these news outlets, but they basically had a window of 1 month. So now we've gone a couple months now with WikiLeaks partnering with, I think it's up to 50 regional newspapers now publishing them, and also publishing them themselves on their site. There are now cases where they put them up on their site. I think that was probably true with some of the Egyptian things where they were in a rush to get them out. They put them up on their own site. So that has changed. But certainly if you're going to come after, and then this is a point many people have made, and that's why it's so important when we see Assange claiming to be an editor or claiming to be a publisher, claiming to be a journalist. He wants to put himself in the same category as the New York Times. And of course, in the New York Times, you have Bill Keller of the New York Times saying, no, Assange is not a journalist. So the New York Times is trying to distance itself from Assange because they don't want the government to come after them. And Assange is trying to embrace the media in the sense that he knows there are much greater protections for the media. But sure, it's hypocritical to, on the one hand, to blame the source for these stories when the newspapers have benefited tremendously from all these scoops. They didn't do anything. They really didn't do anything except go through the cables. They didn't come up with these scoops. They didn't find out this stuff. They weren't publishing things about Suleiman and so forth, corruption in Tunisia and all these other things. It was handed to them. And yet they want to claim full protection and, not so much for WikiLeaks.
Let me just ask you a broader question. What does it mean? I mean, what does it mean for, in a broader sense, this idea that we now have an organization like WikiLeaks, and there's other organizations out there that there's been one that has branched off from WikiLeaks. I would imagine we're going to see more of this in the future. I mean,
right.
The idea that it would take just one soldier to basically upload a thumb drive, which apparently like 2 million people had access to that information,
right.
And it getting out there, and we see the work of Anonymous in sort of being this. It's a completely different type of group, in my estimation, but it is. An extension, at least from an ideological standpoint, almost that there is a sort of this revolt happening with people using the internet as a means
for transparency,
exactly
for transparency. Yeah. Well, the last chapter of my book, I talk about how all these around the world they're. Numerous groups that are claiming to be new leak sites. They usually have leak in their name. Sometimes they're organized around niche issues like the environment and others, or regions or cities or countries. I think the more major one you referred to is OpenLeaks, which
right.
is formed by the ex WikiLeaks guy. And now you have the New York Times and the Guardian and others setting up their own leak portals. However, I have to point out that, since Cablegate broke and these other organizations started forming, there hasn't been a single leak through any of them. I don't know whether they're still processing them or it is a daunting, whistleblowers. I wrote a book on whistleblowers, 30 years ago. And not much has changed. They're, you know, really imperiled once they come out. And, one of the lessons of the Bradley Manning case, I mean, there are people who think the only thing the government cares or the thing the government cares most about, and one reason they're treating Manning so badly is to serve as a lesson and
right.
a warning to other whistleblowers. Now, in fact, WikiLeaks did not expose him. He was not arrested because of some wrongdoing by WikiLeaks or someone else. He was arrested allegedly because of what he revealed about himself. Now we have to see how credible that is and how that
right.
plays out. But in any case, in the public mind, they think, oh, Bradley Manning, whistleblower, Bradley Manning in prison, facing life, at least life imprisonment, if not death. And being, you know, treated horribly in prison. So, and most people don't know how he got there. So it's a great warning to others. And, you know, I don't know how it's going to play out. I certainly have covered the other groups that are going to be processing leaks. But there hasn't been a single major leak in these last months. And WikiLeaks itself has not had leaked anything else. I think they're overwhelmed with Assange's legal case, with
right.
Financial problems, lack of staffing. So, you know, yes, this may be the new era of leaks, but so far it's been more of an era of hacking. You know, the
right.
publicity of the last few months has mainly been the success of Anonymous and, you know, the hacking culture, not so much the leak culture.
We got to wrap this up, but quickly, which of these new leak organizations is would you guess is actually a front for the CIA?
I would not like to speculate.
Right, of course, I understand.
I really don't know. Interesting question, but
right. Well, that really is the question, because that's the next step, isn't it? Is to completely.
Let's hope it's not the New York Times.
Right. Well,
right, if they do it.
We could be a little late on that one. But Greg Mitchell, folks, you got to check out Greg Mitchell's blog. He posts every day the new leaks at the Nation website, and you can download his book digitally, The Age of WikiLeaks, through Amazon, and you can Google. We'll put a link on the blog to where you can purchase the actual print version. Greg Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure, anytime. Appreciate it.
We got to take a break. Actually, no, we've got to end the show. You got bonus time this week today. Total bonus time. You can IM me at Majority FM. If you can become a member, it is your show, folks. You guys make it possible. Without the membership benefits that you provide, this show could not exist. And speaking of Amazon, any purchase that you make through our Amazon link, you can just link there, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon junk through there, and you will be redistributing the wealth. These are the guys who kicked WikiLeaks off their server. I wish there was another program like this. I wish there was another way that I could redistribute the wealth going to these corporate behemoths into my pocket. Believe me, I think about it every day. How can I do that? So far, this is the only way I've been able to come up with it. It is much appreciated. Supports the show. And, of course, Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. 10% off when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. Great tea, great chocolate, great coffee. Coffee prices are going up. Go save yourself 10% at Just Coffee. Stick around for the post show. See you on the flip side. Oh, I should also tell you, new pictures and videos at the blog from Madison I have posted. Just look for the post. Sammy from Madison. Something like that. All right, folks. Oh, and Avant put up a picture stream. You got to check it out. All right, see you on the flip side.